first you told us only through you could we know God, and if we dared to question, he wouldn't spare the rod. For you we worked the soil, for you we dug the moors, for you we shed our blood and fought so many pointless wars. Now you try to tell us there's nothing we can do. You say the world around us belongs fairly to the few. But about 6 billion people, no doubt will agree, this world is our home, not your property. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you who would enclose the land all around the earth, our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. With our sweat we built the railroads, built cities on these shores. But because you own the money, you say that it's all yours. We laid the phone lines and the pipelines, and then right before our eyes, you see these things are taxes paid for. You now will privatize. Privatize the hospitals, privatize the schools, privatize the prisons for all those who break your rules. And preparing for the day when all the wells run dry, you say you own the very rain that falls down from the sky. But it's the commons, our right of birth. And you who'd own the water all around the earth, our future is your downfall. They cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. You claim to own harvest with your Terminator seeds. You claim to own the genomes of every animal that breeds. You claim to own our culture and the music that we play. And with each song that we download to your coffers, we must pay. You'd even own my name, and you'd say it's for the best. Maybe you'll let us on your radio if our songs can pass your test. You own country, you own Western, you say you've given us a choice. You may own the airwaves, but you'll never own my voice. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you who'd own the music all around the earth, our future is your downfall when you cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you who would own everything all around the earth, your downfall when you cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain.
And thank you to David Rovix, the author and singer you just heard, who fortunately we're able to see just last Saturday perform on the Mendocino coast in the town of Mendocino at Rotary Park. The opinions expressed on corporations and democracy are those of our guests and the hosts, and not necessarily of the management of Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Good evening, and welcome to Corporations and Democracy for August 15th, 2024. This is the program that examines how corporations dominate our democracy and what citizens are doing to replace corporate dominance with true democracy. I'm Steve Scalmanini with co-host Annie Esposito. Today we'll begin a series of programs about the state of election integrity as the November general election approaches. On today's edition, we'll be discussing a new book published just a few weeks ago, titled Our Nation at Risk, Election Integrity as a National Security Issue. And I want to begin with a few quotes from the book. Whereas many of the national security risks we have focused on stem from external sources, it has become increasingly clear that some of the most serious challenges stem from within. Indeed, the two threats are interconnected. Not only do foreign adversaries seek to capitalize on the nation's political instability, but the vulnerabilities themselves offer avenues for overseas actors to influence our process. This is the subject of our book. Our Nation at Risk brings together some of our leading political scientists, historians, law professors, and journalists to address the biggest vulnerabilities that our election system faces and to provide numerous recommendations to fix it. The constitutional system on which we rely to determine who will be our president has multiple points of vulnerability that can be manipulated, exploited, and weaponized despite long-standing efforts to implement safeguards. And our guest today is the co-editor of the book, Karen J. Greenberg, Ms. Greenberg is the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law and the editor-in-chief of the CNS Morning Brief and the Aon Cyber Brief. She's the author and editor of numerous books in addition to our subject book today. A few of those other books are Subtle Tools, The Dismantling of American Democracy, From the War on Terror to Donald Trump, and Rogue Justice, The Making of the Security State. She's a future security fellow at New America and a permanent member of the Council on Foreign Relations. And with all that background, we're lucky to have her with us today. So let's have a look at this new book, Our Nation at Risk, Election Integrity as a National Security Issue. Karen J. Greenberg, welcome to Corporations and Democracy.
It's lovely to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yes, thank you so much for taking the time to share all your information, and it's massive. Before we start talking about the book itself, I'd like to dwell just for a minute on the dedication, which is very compelling right now.
Yeah, so we dedicated this book to the poll workers, who are those people who attend to the polls, that explain to voters as they come how to cast their ballots and et cetera. I mean, we've all encountered them every time we go to the polls. Unfortunately, right now, because of the many threats against poll workers, the instability, the threats of violence, the sort of sense of danger around our elections, it's very hard to get poll workers into place. And so you have an issue just not just of getting enough poll workers, but of getting poll workers that are dedicated to doing their jobs the right way, that aren't, you know, working for some other political agenda. It's also important to train them. And so we have to have the time to train them as they come on. So Julian and I just wanted to make it clear how important these individuals are and how much, just support we wanted to convey, and hopefully that our readers would be on the same page.
Mm-hmm. And by the way, to listeners, Julian is the other editor, the co-editor
yes,
of the book, Julian E. Zelizer. Is that the correct pronunciation?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. And I should mention that the poll workers is dedicated to are those still doing poll work, and with some apologies, there are plenty that aren't. I don't know how many hundreds have resigned and bailed out of the process, especially in the very controversial states in the last few years, or 2 to 4 years. Any idea what the number is? I mean, I imagine it might be hundreds.
I've been trying to get some reliable number, and I don't know. You know, there's mm-hmm. predictions of percentages. This is something we can get to later in the conversation, but I really think that this is one of these issues where knowing what the situation is can help those who are charged with making it better and making it secure and making it retain integrity in terms of the appointments and the training can happen. Mm-hmm. But we're getting close.
Yeah, Two and a half months to go. Reminds me of another comment. Now, this is my own opinion, but I'd like your thought about it, if at all. Speaking of poll workers, is that for all the arguments of, stolen this and somebody else, the wrong person, all that's controversy from 4 years ago, I don't remember ever reading any news, any articles, that there were actual poll workers who counted the votes. They're arguing about it. It was always people up with a special interest for one
Correct.
Side or the other. But poll workers,
Correct.
I never read any. So
because it's not their job to count the votes, it's their job to help process, help the voting process go through the way it needs to go through in a legitimate way. But we've seen how these threats are. They mm-hmm. they want to threaten the institution itself, and what better way than to make it uncomfortable or disorienting or be at a loss on voting day. Mm-hmm. And so not to mention all the other things that can happen on voting day. So
great. Well, can you give us a little bit about the beginnings of the book? Somebody got this idea and got numerous people involved. This is one person per chapter, and there's a dozen and a half chapters or so.
Chapters.
Yeah. So tell us, how did this get started?
Well, actually, I think to give credit where credit is due, the credit goes to Julian Zelitzer for thinking it would be a good idea for the two of us to collaborate on a book, which put together the politics that he's always writing about and the national security that I'm always writing about. And obviously we've overlapped on other issues, but he thought this would be a really good idea. And I have to say that one of the things that happened with national security in this century, since the attacks of 9/11, basically, is the sense that national security gets bigger and bigger and bigger in terms of the basket of what goes in. And we've sort of seen that happen. You know, is it terrorism? Is it, you know, domestic terrorism versus international terrorism? What is that? Is it cybersecurity? Is it economic crisis? Is it pandemic? It's just this very big basket that never seems to stop. But the one thing that has become very prominent in recent times is that that national security includes the threat to democracy, and that threat to democracy is particularly rooted in whether or not we can have safe and secure elections, which are trusted in their outcome, in their reported outcome. And so that's how it evolved. But you have to give Julian the credit. I said yes. Was his idea.
Well, thank you for saying yes. And yeah, so that's a theme that's throughout the book, is election security really is a question of your national security. And another theme throughout the book is the people have to be alert. There's so many ways that the system can go wrong that the people really have to be, that's us, need to be paying attention. But one thing that I thought was so interesting about the book, in addition to all of the things that we're going to talk about in the other chapters, is your history at the beginning. And I knew that we had a couple elections that were kind of didn't work out quite right here and there, and somebody conceded who maybe shouldn't have, but they wanted to keep the order or what, for whatever reason. But you've sort of enlightened me and jangled my nerves a bit here that the elections have been sort of hit or miss since the beginning, or since George Washington decided not to take a term of three. Since it's been that long that these elections have been nuts? She's nodding yes.
Yes. Well, so yes, yes, yes. So thank you for yes. It actually surprised me. As I started to put this together and go through the chronology of it, I was like, wait a minute, this must be, this, I must be misreading, you know, and I would go back to other documents and really try to see what had happened over time and how it had happened. And you're absolutely right. The big picture, and then I'll get to the little pieces of it. The big picture is that there have been points of fragility and apparent vulnerabilities in the system of electing a president since the very beginning, since George Washington decided not to go for a third term. And what's happened is that every time it reached a crisis situation, a real crisis, not the little ones, but a real crisis, something happened. Normally Congress passed an act. That's what we see having happened. Or they considered passing an act and then didn't. But they tried to fix this in a sort of a Band-Aid for each one of the vulnerabilities that had been uncovered and revealed. The problem was it was never quite enough. You did this in an incremental way. And then, you know, eventually in the late 19th century. So let me just go back a little bit and just talk about, you know, that first election after Washington didn't want to be king, you know, and wanting to step down. That first election was very interesting because John Adams won the election, but the Democratic Republican, Thomas Jefferson, won the vice presidency. And one thing the founders hadn't thought about and hadn't been thought about in between was, you know, what happens when if you have this, everybody gives two votes, what happens if you have different parties? Because we didn't have the party system as understood and as developed as it later became.
At that time.
And so that was kind of interesting. And then in 1800, Adams sought a second term, and he came in third place. But then there was a tie between Jefferson and his running mate, Aaron Burr. And so they knew very early on that there were problems that didn't necessarily rise to the level of the whole system needed to be recast, but where you understood they needed to be discrete things that were fixed. And so eventually in 1804, Congress passed the 12th Amendment, which amended the two-vote system I just referred to and specified that each member of the Electoral College would cast one vote for president and one vote for vice president. When you read that, you think, of course. You know? But it was, let me tell you that the voting part of the Constitution that was written, that talked about voting and Congress's role in voting and verifying the election and the state's role in the elections, was very much done, and I pointed this out in the essay, in a rushed way. It was done sort of trying to tie up loose ends at the very end and trying to get everything passed. And I don't think that's inconsequential, and a number of historians have mentioned that. But it kept going, you know, even after they had the 12th Amendment, the 1824 election was also problematic. John Quincy Adams lost the popular vote, but his opponent, Andrew Jackson, led both the popular vote and the electoral vote, but he hadn't won a majority. And it sent the decision to the House of Representatives, as the Constitution said it should. And Adams won by one vote.
One vote.
Okay. One vote. I'm just wanted to, that's amazing.
And there was a lot of suspicion around that too, how it came down with that one vote.
Yes, and of course, because it was, you know, the corrupt bargain that he told, Henry Clay intervened and they say, and switched some votes, got people to switch their votes. And they say it was because in trade for him becoming Secretary of State. But the real elections that you have to think about are the major ones that we all know about, that we learn about in school. And I think they're worth talking about. And one of those is the Tilden Hayes election of 1876, you know, because that election required so much ingenuity on the part of the people involved in the discussion on what to do. Right? What to do about an election where they didn't know who was president. Tilden won the national popular vote, but he did not have the electoral vote majority. And so they ended up creating this commission, which is, you know, once you have an idea like this, it can have repercussions in the future. And they end up creating this commission. And then the commission itself had a whole bunch of little things happen that replaced the one person that they were relying on to be a neutral person. And as we all know, Hayes won the election, but it was a warning sign to the country that something needs to be done to be able to address this. And that's where we get the first real legislation that begins to cast forward the Electoral Count Act to talk about how we're going to go forward and what the changes are going to be and how it's going to be certified and how you're going to divide up different parts of the processes. And if you really think about it, even though we've had many, many contested elections, and I write about them here, even though we've had many, if you think about it, for the next century, after Tilden Hayes and the legislation that was passed, we don't see the kind of disruption and one vote, three vote margins and need for a commission, a need for the Supreme Court that we've seen before. And then you have the election of 2000 and Bush v. Gore. And that's when you really see the country start to struggle. And one of the struggles is, yes, we have law. Yes, we have processes. At what point does it just become the letter of the letter of the law, but just the way in which we conduct our elections is somebody resigns and says, yes, this is what it is. I get it. I'm not going to uncover every stone. I'm not going to pull up every, you know, rug and look behind, you know, beneath it.
Someone concedes eventually. Is that?
Yeah, somebody concedes. Yeah. They say the country is more important than the than disputing this, whether it's Nixon or Gore, you know, that believe it or not, you know, that's the spectrum there, that they understand that the system is more important than the actual personality and person of it. And that's actually a very interesting theme that runs from the very beginning of the country in all of these elections that I talk about through, that there's a sense that at some point you give up because the institution is more important. The country is more important. That's changed, right? And when you see the Bush v. Gore, and you understood what happened there, there are some historians who are very, very hard on Gore. You know, it's not on the Supreme Court. It's not on the process that what happened. It's on Gore for ever giving up. which is sort of an interesting take after a century where there really was more or less easier transitions than we had seen right after some earlier elections. So, and then, of course, our most recent elections, and our most recent election, which has just been as fraught with issues that threaten not just the person, the people running, but threaten the system itself.
Mm-hmm. Well, back and, you know, to the Bush v. Gore was a little disconcerting because if I recall correctly, Gore conceded, then rescinded his concession.
He did.
And then conceded it again.
Well, that's right, because, you know, there were different steps in the process. So Bush conceded because the news told, he heard the news channels and he said, he called and congratulated, you know, his opponent and said, you know, congratulations for winning. And then all of a sudden it became clear that there had been some issue about, as you know, issue about the ballots and how they were counted and how clear they were and who'd been able to vote and who hadn't been able to vote. And then the Florida State Supreme Court says it's going to be a recount. Then the Supreme Court of the United States stops the recount, and the rest is history. And then Bush and then Gore does resign. And because that's what people did running for Congress for a president prior to that, you know, and yet he does. There are those who will, you know, attack him on it to this day.
In this Bush v. Gore thing, is that a place where we got into some of the trouble we're in now, where the state electors have more power to decide what is a vote and what isn't?
Well, it's where we started to set. That's a very good question. And it's where we start to see the pattern of how powerful different state entities can be, whether you're talking about the court or you're talking about the legislature. And one of the things that's come up recently, and I think this is what you're really referring to, is the independent state legislator theory. You know, how powerful are the legislatures to make their own rules up as they go along without some kind of oversight by the courts and the state constitutions, as state courts would have it, and then even later on by federal courts. And I think that, you know, that's one of the issues that's had in recent days some pushback, but it's worrisome. And it's worrisome, you know, it's worrisome to see where this will go. So we will see what happens. But it doesn't have the same power and cachet that it had until very recently.
Yeah, so there's something called the Electoral Count Reform Act. And did that help us a little bit?
The ECRA. It helped us a lot. I mean, there are a lot of people that like to criticize it. And it's, of course, just like everything else that has been passed since, you know, those first elections until now, it's not a panacea for everything. But it clarified a lot of what needed to be clarified from the Constitution, from the 12th Amendment, from the Electoral Count Act, from, you know, the end of the 19th century. It clarified things that needed to be clarified and that needed to be clarified a while ago, by the way. And so among the things it clarified were the role of the vice president, which is not to be able to dispute and evaluate votes, but is purely ministerial, which, you know, as president of the Senate, that's a very important thing to have said after what we saw happened in the last election. It raised the bar for where protests could come from to dispute the election counts within the chambers of Congress. And it clarified at the state level some of the things that happen at the state level. For example, who is the official who gets to pass on the electoral count, and that is now the governor. And so it's not perfect. It doesn't deal with a number of issues that have to do with voter suppression, which I think a lot of people would have liked to see. And it doesn't deal with, it doesn't clarify everything in terms of the state level, in terms of how that's going to play out if there is two states of electors, which has happened in many elections where there have been more than one, sometimes three, you know, states of electors that are, you know, submitted. And what do you do with that?
Yeah, from the same state.
Yeah, from the same state. I'm sorry. That's what I meant. From the same state. And so you kind of, it attempts to get at that. But remember, states have a very important role and powerful role in presidential elections and in their role in presidential elections via the Constitution. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of nuance in how the process has to go forward. Yeah. And so the Electoral Count Reform Act does a lot to address what we saw in 2020. And it's not perfect, but nothing has been from the past. And so we're, you know,
things get still
better incrementally getting there.
Yeah, step at a time, but, you know, steps made, but they're often not. And we'll see what polls are available in the next election, perhaps. But that the ECRA did apparently resolve some of the outlandish, in my opinion, claims made 4 years ago in that election. But there will be others, and we'll see what comes up at the next one.
And Karen, you also mentioned Moore versus Harper. And I guess that is something that helped a little bit with this kicking the votes back to the state to decide what to do. At least it makes...
Yeah, I mean, I think that's right. It opened up a path for the federal courts to have a say over state election laws. But, you know, we don't know what that path is, but it's actually very, very important. And some people see it as a way of, say, you know, putting a wedge for the Supreme Court to have a say in federal elections. So, yeah, it's very important beyond what it says, for also for the role of the Supreme Court. I think that's... you know, I think, you know, it's really trying to say the federal courts can have a say. The federal courts can be involved in this once it gets to a certain process. And so, you know, the court rejected the maximalist view of the independent state legislator theory, which we were talking about before. Mm-hmm. And it ruled that the Federal Elections Clause of the Constitution does not empower state legislators to independently set rules free from judicial review from the courts. Mm-hmm. And so it introduces the courts. Mm-hmm. But, you know, then who's sitting on the courts?
Yeah,
and,
well, yeah.
You know, we've seen the really worrisome fragility of our courts when it comes to a whole range of issues that are politically, have a political dimension in one way or another. And, you know, elections is, as I say, a national security concern that really is at the core of our ability to have a stable and future-oriented democracy.
Mm-hmm. Let me mention, listeners, that's already close to the bottom of the hour, so we're discussing a new book just out a few weeks ago, if I saw correctly. It's called Our Nation at Risk: Election Integrity as a National Security Issue. And we're speaking of one of the two co-editors, Karen J. Greenberg, co-editor, and she is the director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law. Is that right? Okay.
Yes.
Great.
Yeah, this is quite a good collection of different elements of what we're talking about. If people want to really understand who can do what, there's a chapter on what the Congress can do, what the President can do, you know, what the Supreme Court can do. It's a lot of little breakdowns that are very informative. A lot of information about the civil rights movement and voting, which of course is what's haunting our whole polarization, I believe, is the fact that there's still people that are being deterred from voting, and that tends to break down racial lines because somebody thinks people that are brown are Democrats. I don't know, but anyway, this is a really, really thoughtful book. Again, it's Our Nation at Risk: Election Integrity as a National Security Issue.
And we've been just discussing some history here in the first 20 minutes or so. But if you'd like to call in, ask any questions of our guests, the number here is 895-2448. That's, of course, in area code 707, 895-2448.
And what we were just talking about was how some of the new decisions have, namely the one about, but the one where they have taken the Supreme Court, the courts can now weigh in on what before the states had kind of gathered under themselves in the way of deciding what the election was. So there's now a court decision in just last year, I believe, that allows us how it is subject to judicial review after all. So I think that means that, but it also invites the courts in to meddle into it, as you also suggested. That's the other pole of it. But I'm assuming now that when we get into this election that's coming upon us very quickly, that there will be these state boards that are going to try to say, never mind what the people in this state voted, here's what we're certifying, and that we will also now have the right to sue. So is that what we're looking at?
Possible. There's a lot of worry right now about election board, you know, officials mm-hmm. who are being appointed that are election deniers from, you know, that, and that that's why they're chosen and that's what's important. How that will actually play out. I mean, I'm one of those people who doesn't like to grasp onto the most dire scenario. That doesn't mean that the dire scenario won't happen. It just means that I just try so hard to think about how how it can work the other way. Ultimately, this is, to your point, going to come down to two things, I think. One, getting out the vote. How many people vote, right. And how many people are not suppressed, you know, whose vote is not suppressed. Mm-hmm. It is absolutely crucial, critical, and all of that. But the other thing is that we have to trust. We don't have to, but it would be good to think that we can trust and therefore learn to trust again. Those who are in charge of making, you know, legitimate decisions about who the electors are, you know, who the electoral count goes to, and that there isn't a lot of shenanigans. And that's going to, you know, that is kind of like my chapter title, A Wing and a Prayer. But I think it's more than that. I think we have to. I'll tell you one thing. One thing that 2020 gave us, the election of 2020 gave us, was some foresight about what to expect. Not just what we're hearing now, but we know the playbook. We know the plan. And by we, I mean law enforcement at the local, state, and federal level. I mean citizens at the local, state, and federal level. We get it. And although there are nuances of it and new ways to, you know, inject some kind of toxin to one part of the process or another, there's also an awful lot of people from Washington all the way on down who are doing their best. And to really marshal their forces, to train poll workers, to interact with board members, election board members, to make this work in a way that we've never seen, this kind of concerted effort to educate the states about disinformation, to educate the states about sign the foreign interference, to educate the states about internet-related issues. There's a massive education program going on, as well as programs about law enforcement, how to you know, protect the polls, how to protect the people going to the polls, how to protect poll workers. So, I mean, if you want to feel optimistic, there might be a little bit in there that would help.
Well, I'm also focusing on what you said about getting out the vote, because I think that's throughout the book, too. Any of these little obscure things that people are going to try to leverage to work around what the way votes should go is harder to do if you have a huge voter turnout.
Yeah, and I think people are getting the message. And as you see, you know, if you look at voter registrations over the past 3 weeks since Vice President Harris became the candidate, mm-hmm. Since she was first in the role of being candidate, and then what you see is massive amounts of registrations from people 25 and under, and that's.
Uh-oh.
Oh, the Zoom just froze.
Yeah, we just froze.
You're back. You froze for about 3 seconds there.
Oh, so what I said, that's interesting. What I said was that this massive amount of voter registrations that have come about in the past few weeks,
yes,
are young voters.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. They're under 25.
Yeah.
And that's a real sign of, can we embrace this moment and make this election work and make it so that this election sort of the shadow that it casts is a shadow of legitimacy mm-hmm. and integrity, as the title of the book says. Yeah.
I know there was an issue in the, I think it was the 2012 election and maybe 2008 too, but there was some writing done, you know, some articles that are in the press about suspicions of the ballot counting being, you know, prearranged or pre-programmed to be close, but nonetheless to go to the opposite of President Obama having won back then. But it was the overwhelming turnout that made the difference. No one could programmed any machines ahead of time for that. And right now, the momentum over the last 2 to 3 weeks has been just astounding, and the news is full of articles about the momentum change and, you know, new registrants and such. So we'll see. That could make for a surprising sweep in a few months.
Well, let me just say one thing that kind of goes to what you said and also what Annie was saying before, is that no matter how much we things, mm-hmm. you know, with this legislation or that legislation or this norm or regulation, no election's perfect. Mm-hmm. Now, this idea that we don't, that the election has to be perfect. Yes, let's aim for it being perfect. Let's do the Ben Franklin thing. He was always aiming for things that, you know, were far above what everybody could do to live the perfect life. Mm-hmm. But you can aim for that, but it's not going to be perfect. And that's the buried truth throughout mm-hmm. all of these elections that we've been talking about. And that's okay. It has to be almost perfect. It has to be legitimate. And in order to be legitimate, it's not, there may be problems here and there, but it can't destroy the whole system. And that's, I think, where we are right now as a country.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I won't bring up what Alec de Tocqueville said, that American presidential elections are a recurring crisis.
Yeah, no, I know. Well, yeah, but that's okay, because it's now we have to take care of it. You know, it's like we can't just keep pushing this down the road as if it doesn't exist. And so 2020 showed us that. Mm-hmm. And it was a wake-up call, or I think I call it a full-scale alarm, whatever. It was, you know, and that's what we're doing.
Yeah, so this is an amazing book, and I want to talk about some of the other chapters just to let people know, our nation at risk, election integrity as a national security issue, edited by Karen Griegbert, our guest, along with Julian Zelizer. Am I saying that right?
Yep.
And let me remind listeners, if you want to call in with a question or comment, 895-2448.
So the book is divided into several parts. There's a historical part and a part on oversight, and then a part on nuts and bolts of administering the election. But one of the chapters that I thought our listeners would be interested in right now is Combating Extremism. So this is by Richard Pildes, wrote this?
Yes, that's how you say it, yes. He's at NYU, a professor of law at NYU.
I thought he makes the point several times that I thought is really important, is that the extremism or the polarization that we're experiencing right now is coming from top down, that it's not just geographical or inequality. It's being driven by elites on the unelite. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's a really interesting essay, and you know, it goes places. That sort of, so he has this notion of affective polarization, right? And what he means by affective polarization is that not just the polarization that we talk about when we say there's extremism, like you were just saying, but the idea that it's an existential crisis this moment, and it's an existential crisis for the country. And so the polarization is that both sides of the polarity believe that if they lose, the country's gone. The country's lost, mm-hmm. you know, and that's what he plays out. And he does a very good job articulating how it is driven by these elites, and other essays in the book as well, other chapters of elites as well, which I have to say, when I was reading them all, was a theme that appeared to me that I don't think is really, you know, discussed in public a lot. You know, it's sort of like scholars may talk about it, but I was really glad that it came through in the book. And so, you know, Professor Pildes has a, you know, a variety. He doesn't really talk about the extremism that we talk about today, which is on the streets, that promotes violence. He's not really talking about extremist groups, extremist lone wolves, or anything like that. He really is talking about the from the top, the elites and the message they're sending with this affective sense of crisis, this affective polarization. And so he has a number of, you know, incremental issues that he thinks would help things, you know, more competitive election districts than there are now, which is, you know, one of the big issues in electoral politics that we haven't talked about is, you know, gerrymandering, for example, and how you set up districts and what districts are okay to set up and which ones violate the law and which ones don't violate the law. And all of this part of the larger conversation about voter suppression, right? And about, you know, are votes being made in a way, not just that they can vote, but their vote counts, you know, and how we've divided up voting lines. And so, you know, he talks about redoing that. He talks about one thing that's really interesting that he talks about is the title of the section, if I remember, is Eliminating the Party Primary.
Oh, right? Yes, right.
Eliminating, right? He talks about, and I found that the most interesting part of the chapter, that, you know, maybe what we should do is get rid of the primary because it's really not helpful. It takes away from what the election really should be about. And you know, given what we're seeing right now with Harris's, you know, rise to this position that she's in now as the candidate, and the truncated period of time between this and the election, and how it happened sort of without the kind of primary that we're used to. Mm-hmm. He wrote this before that happened. But they kind of resonate with one another, I think, what he says and the moment at hand. So whatever. But it's a good chapter. And then, you know, of course, on campaign finance, which I think most people who talk about structural problems talk about. But anyway, it's very interesting chapter, yes.
Yeah, well, one of the things about the party primary, which has lower voter turnout, is he says that it fuels extreme candidates, which I thought was interesting. That
right.
If you didn't have a primary, if it was just everybody was just running in the same race, you would have a different distribution of votes, and you wouldn't end up with this extremist candidate.
On the other hand, you know, the other idea is that, you know, you want to live in a system where those people who are attempting to run on the fringes or run on, you know, on those kinds of things, that the process takes care of them themselves. You know what I'm saying? Like, in a way, you can't. I'm not that opposed to the idea that everybody can try, but this just wouldn't work. You know, yeah. As opposed to no, that we're not gonna go there. And I maybe again, I'm being a little too rose-colored glasses, but that's just the nature of the beast.
The same issue of extremism tends to be less influential on elections that are done by ranked choice voting and instant runoff voting. Although I've lost track of which, I know some municipalities do it and maybe some counties. I'm not sure of any states that are doing it, so I'm not up on that.
Yeah, but, you know, it's really interesting, the ranked choice voting. You know, when you read about it, you're sort of like, yeah, that makes sense. And then, of course, it's got, you know, it echoes with European style of doing things more than we're seeing here, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that may be the wave of the future, actually. I think that, you know, could happen. Yes. But again, all these structural fixes are very interesting, and they you know, can fix one piece or another, you know, like if you're building a Lego set and you're putting them all together. But the ultimate goal is not to have it so that a destructive presence and power and organization can actually dismantle whatever it is you're putting together on your, you know, building apparatus. And that is, you know, the biggest worry. And that's where the courts are actually very, you want the courts to be very, very important. That's what we have. And so, you know, Moore v. Harper that you were mentioning, is very important, I think, decision, you know, getting to that point, you know, reinvigorating the role of the courts, both state and eventually federal.
Yeah, and Moore v. Harper is just the case, Supreme Court case last year, and so clarified some of the who can do what in the electoral vote counts.
That was the name I was trying to remember.
Yeah. So once again, we're speaking with Karen J. Greenberg. She is co-editor of a new book, Our Nation at Risk, Election Integrity as a National Security Issue. And once more, the number to call in with any comments or questions is 895-2448. It's pretty quiet this evening, but let's see what anyone has to say about it, who wants to call in.
Yeah, along with the primaries that you were talking about just a minute ago, as a way to have more moderate candidates. That's the argument in this chapter on extremism. He also says that competitive districts does the same thing. If you don't have a competitive district, then you don't have to appeal to the middle, and you're going to get your Marjorie Taylor Greens. And then it's kind of the same way with the primaries, where ranked choice voting really worked for a moderate Republican in Alaska. Yeah. Murkowski was reelected because they had that ranked choice voting. It wasn't an all or nothing, winner take all. And so that encourages moderation. All of his things that he's mentioned there that you talked about are to create moderation and less of the polarization that we have going on right now.
I think something to point out, and I think people know this, and is that, you know, the idea of having competitive districts, for example, right, is, you know, at some point you can't just people are who they are. And what we're finding out is that there's a very deep, and Professor Pildes refers to this, tribalism that has overtaken sort of American discourse and American electoral politics. And that you can try to, you know, make these competitive districts. But the fact is that this tribalism is extremely powerful and important to the members of the tribes. And the question is, how do we move beyond that as a country? And the answer is, while the election's extremely important in many, many ways, moving beyond it as a country is more than just the election and the electoral process. You know, it's about understanding who we are as a people. And so one of the messages is, you know, are we about unity, or are we about discord? Are we about trying to figure things out together, or are we about, you know, trying to, you know, go to our tribes? And we're at a moment where we haven't decided that, and the election can't completely decide that, but it sure can help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I found a whole bunch of stuff in this book that was interesting. Let me repeat it again for our listeners. It's Our Nation at Risk, Election Integrity as a National Security Issue, edited by Julian Zeltzer and Karen J. Greenberg, our guest, Karen Joy Greenberg. I like your middle name, so I wanted to get it in there.
Thank you.
So there's a lot in this book about the civil rights. And on Chapter 5, after the Civil Rights Revolution, that's when a lot of this polarization started. But do we have a call?
No.
Oh, okay. Oh, Steve's checking the phone to make sure it's working. A lot of the polarization began. They're giving this Chapter 5. He's giving you the date it began. It was July 2nd. 1964, when Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act. The Watts riots broke out 6 days later. Do you have some comments on that, of how this is following along our whole history, really?
In a way, it kind of, you just said it, which is that the power of voter suppression has been a meme that has been consistent throughout American history, and particular in the post 15th Amendment, post Civil War period, and we are still struggling with that in terms of, you know, how many different ways can you try to suppress votes, and the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was an incredibly powerful and important attempt to prevent discrimination at the polls. And it was in place until the Voting Rights was has been somewhat gutted in terms of the ability to use any of the institutions of government to be able to forestall such discrimination. And so what we're really seeing, look, that's another reason this is a very important election, because we know how much voter suppression attempts are going on. We know how much this has been a long-standing crisis that seems to have revived itself in recent years with the kind of overt racism that we're seeing throughout our society, not just when it comes to elections and elsewhere. And that's another reason this election's really important, because it can work. People are going to be able to vote, and provided the deterrence to violence are in place, and provided that the deterrents to wrongful messaging and disinformation are in place. In other words, you know, disinformation of the ilk of, oh, no, you thought your electoral, your voting place was here. No, it's not there. It's in another place, to mislead voters, or take this bus and we're going to take you to X where, and then they take them to nowhere. You know, or all of the many different tactics that we've seen and that we're hearing about to deter and disrupt the election so that the vote is suppressed. We know what's coming. And I think there's a lot on election officials. You know, when you talk about the dedication of the book, the weight of this on the people who have to mount the elections, make sure they work, make sure people are safe, make sure they themselves are safe, and make sure, in addition to all of that, that the count happens the right way. It's an extraordinary amount of pressure. But you know what? It can happen. And it can happen in a viable and successful way. And that's what I think, anyway. That's what I want to think.
Yeah, well, the book, it has all of those angles, and I really appreciate that. Just about everything that you can mention is a double-edged sword, like you were referring to the courts. They can save the situation or they can make it worse. And the same with the state. You're talking about how dangerous voting can be under certain circumstances, that the state, which is... We're looking at state boards and becoming alarmed at what they might be doing, but the state also is the entity that protects you when you go to the poll to vote.
Right. I mean, yeah. And one of the things that's happening at the federal level, there's been a little bit of reporting on this, is the way in which the Department of Justice is trying to get ahead of threats of violence, actual threats of violence, not just rhetoric, but those with the intent and the capacity of some sort to commit acts of violence around the election and election-related issues, and other crimes that can be committed that can be intercepted in these, you know, because when you think about an election, there's really three periods of it. There's the period before the election, which we're in now. There's election day, which is, you know, where we're all focused. And then there's a period, as we learned from 2020, after the election, mm-hmm. which is also, the votes are there. But what's going to happen in between the day the votes are cast and counted and when they are certified, right? And how is that going to play out? And again, there are an awful lot of officials at all different levels working to anticipate the problems, and we'll, you know, we're, everybody is watching this, you know, in the country with that knowledge.
Well, that's certainly one of the themes of the book, is that people need to be paying attention, because anywhere there's no, probably no such thing as a structure that doesn't have built-in vulnerabilities, and so the people need to be on high alert. And it sounds like you think that we are. So let's.
You know, I want to trust the voter. I want to try. Yeah, I know there are a lot of bad actors. I know there are bad intentions. I know there are very powerful people who have figured out ways to engineer things from within in a way that would compromise the result. But I do think that that there are some safeguards in place, and that, you know, that I also think that voters do have a degree of intelligence. I think citizens have a degree of intelligence, And they see what's happening. And you can see it now in the last 3 weeks since President Biden stepped down from his candidacy. You can see the way in which all of a sudden these people who are just coming out, trying to participate in the process, trying to articulate what the issues are, trying to reach voters that other people haven't cared about for a long time, actually reach them, actually talk to them, actually understand what they need out of their leadership. So anyway,
I think it's a minor miracle that when we had Biden withdraw as a candidate, that instead of total chaos, there was immediate, everybody in the party fell behind the vice president as the logical solution, and like it got to work. It was so there's strains of sanity.
I'm so glad you mentioned this. I was writing an essay at the time before he decided not to run about this sense of chaos, that everybody was afraid of the chaos. And you're right. Columnists in the newspapers and on TV and everywhere was like, there's going to be chaos. He can't step down. It'll be just utter chaos. We won't know. And I was like, bring it on. We could use some of the energy that chaos would be. And people looked at me like, what is wrong with you? But it worked. You know, it was okay. So I'm so glad you brought that up, because I think we've all forgotten it as a nation, you know, just sort of like, oh yeah, of course this is the way it happened. It's been great, you know. No, there was tremendous fear.
And all those concerns are 4 weeks ago's news and forgotten.
We forgot
quickly. But you emphasize very much that it's public vigilance that can make such a big difference. So especially I'm thinking in swing states that I hope they're under the close eye of those who care about election integrity in those states. If there's another, what was it called? The Brooks Brothers riot, that particular year in 2000, that there's a group keeping a close eye on those people to see that those elections still go as they should and the counting goes as it should. So
we only have 3 minutes. Maybe we should give Karen a chance to tell people how to catch up with her. Do you have a blog somewhere? Yeah, do you have a blog or?
I write pretty frequently for a lot of publications, mostly for something called Tom's Dispatch. Which I write for, actually these days pretty frequently. And I write elsewhere. You know, it just depends on what the moment is and what's happening. And I usually post things on my Center on National Security website at Fordham Law. We just did a big report on the Department of Justice and the need for reform and what those reforms might look like.
Mm-hmm. And I do have a copy. Yeah, I have a copy of the front page, web page for the Center on National Security.org.
Okay.
So it's www.centeronnationalsecurity.org. And it has your latest stuff there, right there in the middle of the page. It's closing Guantanamo won't be enough. And two decades later, we still know too little about the government's torture program, and et cetera. And one that caught my eye, our democracy is more fragile than we would like to think. So, but that's some of your good work is there. So,
I do a lot of work on Guantanamo.
Well, we have 1 minute to do so. We need to do our outros. So, thank you for being with us today. And I hope we didn't go beyond people's interest. Not getting calls, but as we usually get. But nonetheless, it's been a pleasure to have you on the program. This is Karen J. Greenberg, co-editor of the new book, Our Nation at Risk, Election Integrity as a National Security Issue, from NYU Press, right? New York University Press.
Order it through your local bookstore or from the NYU Press.
Great. Okay. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks, you guys. It was a pleasure.
You.